There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 211. Today is January 1st, 2014. Happy Nuke Year to you all. With me today, I have an August group of, actually a January group of people who are here to talk to you a little bit about what happened in 2013, some of the good, the bad, the ugly, and talk about what we hope is going to happen in 2014 in the nuclear world. The voices you'll hear today include Meredith Angwin, who blogs at Yes Vermont Yankee.
Hi.
Gwyneth Cravens, who is the author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy, and also a one of the former anti-nuclear people who were featured in the movie Pandora's Promise, which we will talk about as one of the events of 2013 that we thought was a good one. How are you doing, Gwyneth?
I'm doing great, and I'm happy to be here.
All right. Steve Applin is with us from Canadian Energy Issues. How are you doing, Steve?
Great. Great to be here.
Les Corrice from Hiroshima Syndrome, who has one of the absolute best source of information on the web about Fukushima. Les updates that twice a week, I believe, and he's been doing that ever since March 2011. How are you, Les?
I'm doing great, and thanks for the kind words.
Hey, I keep getting people on my blog who ask me, why don't you spend more time keeping us updated on what's going on at Fukushima? And I've taken to just simply saying, why would I want to duplicate somebody else's great efforts? And send them links to your blog. So,
and it's been very nice. Thank you.
Well, I'm lazy. I don't want to have to do this. You put in a lot of work on that and have developed some information sources and understanding of the day-to-day events, which, you know, I have been having people asking me, well, how come nobody's paying attention to these non-events? And I say, well, maybe because they're not events. But anyway, so how you doing? And let's see, Susie Hobbs Baker. I'm sorry, Susie. I sometimes forget. You get into old habits. But Susie Baker is with us, who is the director of Pop Atomic Studios and the also the leader of the Nuclear Literacy Project. How you doing, Susie? Susie, you still here? Uh-oh. Susie, are you on mute?
Oh, hey, Rod. Sorry, I'm muted with my ear accidentally. Sorry, I'm here. Thank you for the introduction.
Yeah, I couldn't see any indication that you had dropped off, so I went to the next troubleshooting step on my list here and said, check to see if they're on mute.
Sorry, that was my fault.
I've been doing enough conference calls over the years to recognize that when you have dead silence from somebody, it's usually because they've hit the button. You know, it's funny. I always had the conference phones on some of my most recent employers have been phones where the mute button is right next to the hang-up button.
Mm-hmm.
and you always tell everybody, yeah, go on mute when you're not talking. And, of course, invariably somebody hangs up the phone while they're trying to keep quiet. So, all right. Did I forget anybody? I want to do that on occasion. Okay, I guess I got everybody. So let's talk about what we think is the most important things that happened in 2013. And I'm going to start off with, I think, probably the most impactful thing that happened in the year was the theater release of Pandora's Promise and the rather large number of conversations that movie has spawned. it's to me a very important event, because it has gotten a lot of people who have been reflexively anti-nuclear to take a little step back, think about why they had the opinion they did, and to talk about it with other people, and maybe in some cases to even change their mind. So what do you all think?
I agree. I didn't see it in the theater. I haven't been around the Cleveland area where I live, but I saw it on CNN, and I was very impressed. I thought you did a great job, Renat.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, I was really thrilled to see it in that. I just kept on telling my colleague, I know her. I traveled through France with her.
It's always nice to claim knowledge and personal friendship with a movie star. So.
Yep,
right. I agree. Well, I'll have my people talk to your people, and you know, we can work something out. I can make an observation, and if I'm just repeating myself from a former atomic show, stop me. But I went in January. They had the Sundance Festival, where Pandora's Promise was screened, and I was invited to go, and some other people went. Dick Rhodes was there when I was there. We missed Stuart Brand, who was in the previous week, and it was just very surprising what the audience reaction was, because Sundance is not like, you know, it's not made up of nuclear engineers. The people who come are film buffs and, you know, that sort of thing. But the reaction was just amazingly positive. Dick Rhodes and I did a Q&A after the showing, and then they kicked us out because they had to screen a new film in that room, and so we were out in this little hallway, and it was packed with people who wouldn't leave. And they kept wanting to talk to us, and some other people, like Robert Stone, was around too. And so, you know, they were grabbing his lapels, and people really wanted to know more. It's not like they had a conversion on the spot, but they wanted to know more. And I was told by some of the PR people that they did a survey of the audiences. There were several showings of the film during the 2-week film festival, and I don't know exactly how they did this, whether they gave people ballots or how it worked, but the change of minds among the audience was going from 30% pro nuclear to around 70% pro nuclear after they'd seen the film. So that was head spinning, to say the least. I thought we would be jeered and booed and attacked and so on. And on the contrary, people did ask questions, the usual questions that people who aren't, you know, who haven't delved into this any, or who have heard what the antis have to say. But I found them responding very reasonably.
Yeah, one of the things that also has happened is that those people who have been professionally involved in the battle to either slow or stop nuclear energy development have reacted a little bit differently than those who are, you know, members of the organization, maybe who that's not really their major issue. They just sort of went along with that because it was the, you know, one of the planks of the membership group. Some of the people that I'm thinking of are people like Tom Cochran from the Natural Resource Defense Council, or Ed Lyman. Many of them have published, and Joe Rahm have published articles saying, hey, you know, Pandora's Promise, once over lightly, doesn't really delve into the deep issues. It's not really changing anybody's minds in our neck of the woods. And, you know, that response is... has been a little bit of a strong pushback from them, at least publicly.
Sounds to me, though, like it's hollow rhetoric. I mean, of course they're going to be coming up with, you didn't go into the issues deeply enough, but I think the issues were deeply investigated. The ones that you could do. I mean, you can only do so much in, what, an hour and 40 minutes, the length of the documentary?
Right.
Yes, and then they complain about, why didn't they talk about this? Why didn't they? I mean, it's just like if you read Gone with the Wind, you say, well, why don't they bring it into the 20th century? And, why do they keep talking about the Civil War? I mean, maybe there could be a sequel.
Well, certainly the answer to any publication of any size can be, well, you didn't cover everything. Gwyneth, you as a professional editor know that everybody's got to make decisions on what you cover, and part of Stone's purpose was to make a film that was still watchable.
Yes, Stone is a good editor. He's himself a very good writer.
Yes.
And so he pays attention to words and so on. And I think his editing was very, very careful. I mean, he interviewed me for a really long time. I mean, I don't know, 3 hours or something like that, a total.
And you end up to get about 10 minutes in. No, I'm just teasing.
Yeah, and then, there's a few exclamations and remarks, and that's about it. But he figured out what was needed to build the story he was building. And I, as a novelist, I had to really appreciate his
storytelling.
And as an editor, too, I appreciated how he managed the whole thing. I can't imagine doing that myself. It was really good.
Yeah, well, let's move on to another topic. One of the things that has been happening this year is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been going to court on some of its previous actions and activities, and not doing so well. There's been a couple of court rulings that have basically told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, no, you're not, haven't been doing your job, and this is what we want you to do now. Particularly the Yucca Mountain decision, the halting of the Yucca Mountain review in 2009 was pointed to by courts as being a real problem. Y'all know what happened after that?
Well, basically, the courts said, you've got to start dealing with it. You've got to start moving forward. I mean, they've been dragging their feet for a long time, and I know a lot of it's been political, but,
100% political.
All right.
There were no technical issues involved in the decision to stop.
Right. And I think it's a good thing that the court, somebody was wise enough to say, hey, get moving. Enough with this backsliding or not moving at all, because you want the issue to be resolved, you've got to do something, and they weren't doing anything.
Well, the courts were very strong on this. They sent a writ of mandamus, which is, I probably said that wrong, which was basically saying, you have just disobeyed the law, and this is not allowed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's right. A very strong thing to send to an agency or a company to say, this is it. You have disobeyed the law. You've got to stop doing that. The trouble is that, Harry Reid immediately went on the air and said, we're going to ignore it. And
because I'm Harry Reid and I own Nevada.
Right.
Yeah, and
I am the Gaming Commission own Nevada.
And this,
really?
This is a really scary thing. For me,
I just find it scary, not because he owns Nevada. Maybe he owns Nevada. I find it scary that even if you own Nevada, right after a court rules, you can get up in public and say, that isn't going to make any difference.
Well, the thing that always comes to my mind is, who the hell cares who owns Nevada? It's a very low density population state. It's run by a bunch of people whose morals are questionable at best. Why is that state so feel like they have the ability to ignore federal law? As far as I remember, federal taxpayers own more than half the state.
Well, I used to have to go there for geothermal, and I would say that there are a lot of people in Nevada that really want to show that they have some power over the federal government. And I don't mean that in a way that they're, you know, about one issue or another. I feel it's more like the federal government does own a huge portion of the land in Nevada, which means that people who live on the other portions of the land sometimes think that they don't get to make any choices about their zoning or how their land is used in their neighborhood, because it's all BLM or National Forest land anyway, and the federal government's going to make the decisions. And plus which, you know, they have a lot of military training there, and you know, a lot of people think it's great, and a lot of people think, I don't know if they still have this, but when I was there, there was a very active organization that was just trying to limit the number of sonic booms that people in Nevada had to put up with. Because, you know, people on the East Coast go and say, well, I think they should practice all that stuff in Nevada, and they do. And then nobody in Nevada gets, you know, everybody in Nevada has to put up with not just occasional, but frequent. And so, sonic boom. So there was a lot of resentment of the federal government, and I felt that, you know, a savvy politician in Nevada would turn that to his advantage and fight the federal government on something to show that he wasn't going to let Nevada be pushed around the way it always was. I mean, and they did drop a lot of A-bombs there, too, if you remember.
Oh, yeah. They didn't just drop them. They actually drilled holes and kept blowing them up underground, too. So, yeah, the test site was you know, a substantial endeavor. And I guess I understand to a certain extent, but, of course, as a someone who served the United States of America, I never really had much concern about states' rights. I think that, you know, the United States of America is a single country, that we came together to be a stronger place many, many years ago.
Well, I totally agree with you, and I assure you that when I hear people who are supposedly very liberal in Vermont, who have been against Vermont Yankee, talking about the rulings that went against the state and saying, oh, it's a sad day for states' rights, this ruling. And I'm thinking, that's good. Because I grew up with a sad day for states' rights is what you wanted.
Right.
You know, because that might mean there wouldn't be poll taxes and there'd be, you know,
slavery.
Jim Crow would go away.
Yeah,
civil
exactly.
rights would be.
I mean, so when I hear one of our liberal politicians lament that it's a sad day for states' rights, I'm like, oh, my. But nevertheless, I think that some of the areas in the West, not so much in the, you know, California is a vibrant economy, and a lot of the land is park, and a lot of the land is privately owned and so forth. But you get to a place like Nevada where so much of the land is Bureau of Land Management land, and people just feel like they're running it. The federal government's running it. I'm against them, just because they can't vote on how local land is used.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's...
Can I ask a question? Because I'm a little bit naive on the Nevada situation itself, other than how it's affected national, but have they ever run any kind of a statewide poll or survey to find out what the rank-and-file people in the state think of Yucca Mountain?
Yes, and the majority are in favor of it.
Particularly the people in Nye County, which is the place where
yes.
the facility would be located.
Yeah. The number of jobs that could be created, just like, you know, people running their diners or you know, gas stations and on the path the trucks would take to bring the waste to Yucca Mountain, all of that, I mean, they've calculated the enhancement for the state, and it would really improve income and jobs. And I don't know the current situation, but when I was talking to people about it, they said it would be a great boon to Nevada to have the waste facility there. It was the people in Las Vegas who
were afraid the gaming, people wouldn't come to gamble anymore because of the terrible radiation that would become pouring out of Yucca Mountain and into the casinos.
Well, that's what they said.
It just was not a tourist attraction for
them.
That's
what they said they were worried about.
Yes. Well,
if the majority, if the rank and file in the state are not averse to Yucca Mountain, then where does Harry Reid get off fighting it tooth and nail? That's the sort of thing that bothers me with politics. Yes.
He's but backed by the gaming commission,
don't
according
forget,
to
politics
what I've been told.
In the United States today is not about representing the voters, but about representing your paying constituents.
Exactly.
So, all right, exactly. Let's move on to another one. Because of the fact that the NRC canceled the Yucca Mountain Review, and essentially has no other plans other than a vague. Maybe we'll get around to it someday, creation of some sort of repository. Another court has told the DOE that they're not happy with the continued collection of fees.
Right.
One of the interesting cases is, of course, the law associated with collecting the nuclear waste fund fees is that the DOE, the Secretary of the Department of Energy, has to certify each year that the fees being collected are adequate for the task and not excessive. And the court said, we're sorry, Secretary Moniz, how can you say that the fees are neither excessive and also adequate when you have no idea what the plan is?
Right.
It was kind of an interesting ruling that some of the matter of fact, that when I read the I should have pulled it up before we started talking. When I read the opinion by the judges in the case, it was pretty direct and somewhat humorous when they
said, old razzle dazzle.
Yes, yeah.
That's the phrase. They said that it was like DOE was trying to give everybody the old razzle-dazzle.
Getting
something for
Chicago.
Nothing, you know.
Well, you know, and when they gave a range of costs, the range of costs was, I think between the top and the bottom was maybe an order of magnitude or more in cost, and the court said, well, you have no basis for even that large range, and please explain. And they said, well, we have a large range because we're uncertain.
And So
I think that right now, if I understand the ruling correctly, the fees are still being collected, but they may have to stop pretty soon. Does anybody have any better understanding of that?
Not me, no.
I think that's correct. I also think that the fees not being collected, I've watched a very pro-nuclear person on Facebook write, that sounds terrible. Then that means that there would really be no way to deal with the waste if they stop collecting those fees. And I had to point out that there is plenty of money to deal with the waste that they have so far, because they've collected, fees enough to build, two or three Yucca Mountains.
Billions of dollars, right?
They collect $700 million a year, you see, so that's quite a few billions, $35 billion, I believe. I looked it up at one point, even on Wikipedia, and but the problem is that you have to explain to people that there's enough money in there already, because otherwise even pro-nuclear people say, oh my gosh, if they're not collecting fees, they've just given up on waste disposal. We're never going to do anything with it. And that isn't true. There's plenty of money to do something with it.
Well, of course, as I pointed out, the whether or not the fee is adequate really depends on what the plan is to create. I mean, you can spend, and our government has proven the ability to spend almost an infinite number of dollars without any results at all. So,
yeah.
Forget that.
Meanwhile, there is the waste isolation pilot plant that's been safely storing nuclear waste since 1999.
Right.
And there's no reason why all of the spent fuel, commercial fuel, couldn't be taken to the waste isolation pilot plant as well. It's just a rule in Congress that they just made up at the last minute. It was supposed to take commercial waste, and then they changed it that it would only take military waste.
Well, there are people.
It could.
Yeah, it could. But there are people, including myself, who question whether or not whether or not used nuclear fuel should go into the waste isolation pilot plant type salt formation, because that is a non-retrievable place to put it.
I'm told by people who worked on WIP, like Rip Anderson, that no, it could be retrieved.
Okay.
There are ways of making it retrievable.
Yeah.
It's not. There is stuff you would want to just really bury.
Yes,
But it would be quite possible. Because that's 98% of fuel is still valuable. It's still got stuff that we could use. Yeah.
And so, from my point of view, we really have been storing used nuclear fuel quite safely for many years.
Yes.
I see no reason why anything would happen that would change that. And when I used to manage a factory, one of the things I learned was, if you have inventory that you know you're going to use eventually, don't spend a lot of money moving it from place to place.
Yeah.
Because moving your inventory just simply makes it cost more without adding any value to it. So
right.
We have an inventory of used nuclear fuel that needs to be recycled at some point, but until we build the recycling facilities and know where to put it, we shouldn't move it around willy-nilly.
There are people who say if you build a fast reactor at a nuclear plant, it can burn up all the uranium fuel and make electricity at the same time.
Yes, that's
true. One fast reactor for three, regular reactors. And problem solved, except for, the residual waste, which is tiny and could just be vitrified.
Well, I had an interesting conversation with Tom Cochran of the NRDC on that particular issue, and he said, the numbers actually work out to be you would need large numbers of fast reactors operating for hundreds of years to actually consume all of that 98% or 95% of the material. Because, if you only consume 5% so far, you're going to have to create a lot of fissions to fission the other 95%. Of course, creating a lot of fissions mean you'll be producing a lot of power for a long time. And I think that would be such a tragic thing to have to spend all that time producing power for so many years for so many people to get rid of all that used material.
He apparently thinks it's tragic.
Okay, you see where I'm going. I'm being ironic here. Wait a minute. Wow, that's really bad.
Yeah. So there are centuries of electric power,
Right.
As much as you want. As much as you want, too.
Right. You have to figure out ways to get rid of all this electrical power. I'm sorry.
The predictions are use of electricity will just continue to grow.
Well, I think that there's many things that I would like to use electricity for that we can't do right now because it's just too expensive. But wouldn't it be nice if you could have like heaters under your roads? When the snow starts falling, you just turn on the road.
Yeah.
We just got 6 inches last night, so I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Who needs plows? Just heat the roads. Of course, I used to have walkways at my university that were that were never got snowed on. Actually, there was always snow, but well, not always snow, but the walkways wouldn't have any snow stick. And everybody wondered about that. It's like magic. Of course, they were steam tunnels underneath the walkways. Mm-hmm. That's where our campus steam lines ran, was right underneath the walkways. It was brilliant. It worked great. All right. Susie, you've been very quiet. What do you think is the most important thing that happened in 2013 from a nuclear perspective?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I'm just listening. I mean, a lot happened. I think in terms of educational outreach, because that's where I sort of exist, is the tone changed this year. You know, I think 2012, after Fukushima, was still just trying to get our footing and respond to public concern and figure out how to re-enter the dialogue in a proactive way. And I feel like that actually happened this year, that the industry and independent supporters and all kinds of folks just kind of came back to the table and said, you know, we are so sorry that this happened and it's horrible, but, you know, we have to keep talking about this. We can't write it off. It's still very important. And so I think to me, just that energy and just seeing things evolve in that way was really important and exciting and hopeful. Obviously, Pandora's Promise was a big part of that, but I even think within the industry itself, there's been a change in that people are being more proactive. And they're seeing that outreach is effective, and they're growing those efforts, and they're realizing that we can't only respond when there's an accident. We have to be constantly reaching out.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head, and I will point to one unfortunate motivator for that kind of change in heart within the industry is I think a lot of people were awakened this year as they watched announcements for the closure of Kewaunee, Crystal mm-hmm. River, San Onofre, and the future closure of Vermont Yankee. And people right. are saying, you know, we can't just let our installed base of reactors slowly disappear because we haven't taken the time to help people understand why they're important and what benefits they bring, even if their minute-to-minute production of electricity is not the cheapest source today.
Right, and that's such an American, you know, issue, and because globally, nuclear growth is going forward. The renaissance is happening, and America's falling behind. And so, yeah, I think here at home, we're finally starting to rally. And unfortunately, perhaps it has been at the cost of losing facilities or having facilities go offline that we should have been more proactive with the exception of Meredith's hard work at Vermont. Oh,
I wasn't worried about you not giving me credit, Susie. Thank you. Thank you very much.
But yeah, I mean, it's so interesting and challenging, but I think I'm glad that everybody's working so hard on it and sees that it's a necessity. I just feel grateful for that. Because when I came to the game 5 years ago, it was like pulling teeth to get industry or even the existing outreach efforts to try anything new or different or engage in sort of novel ways. So we're seeing a lot more of that now.
There have also been a number of, this is not about the industry, but about people commenting on nuclear power who were formerly opposed to it, like Rick Hertzberg at The New Yorker.
Absolutely.
And when I worked at The New Yorker, and after I worked at The New Yorker, it was very anti-nuclear anything. You could not talk to them. And to see Hertzberg, who's one of the major editorial writers there, come out in a kind of backhanded way, supporting nuclear power was absolutely stunning. And there have been some other turnarounds like that that I think are contributing to the public dialogue, because people really are putting together carbon emissions with climate change in a helped by the climate scientist who has come out very strongly in favor of nuclear power, and who people like Jim Konka writing for Forbes about the enormous uptick in carbon emissions in California as a result of San Onofre.
And in Japan and Germany as well. It's actually kind of interesting that the, you know, Fukushima incident has sort of indirectly set the stage to say, okay, renewables, step in and take over if you can, and no one can really make it work with the carbon reductions. Right. And so that's kind of a funny silver lining-ish situation where it's like a lot of the renewable advocates are getting what they've asked for and we're not seeing carbon reductions. So that's big.
Yeah, what we are seeing is increased consumption of coal, natural gas, and oil.
Especially in Japan.
Yep.
They've shut down their 50 nukes, and I think it's right now they're running at a $1 billion a month trade deficit on the importing of mostly liquid natural gas, but more oil and some new coal plants that they just started up. But it's mostly liquid natural gas. These fuel costs are hurting an economy that isn't exactly the most healthy at this point for a large number of reasons. But they couldn't make their commitments to greenhouse reductions or greenhouse gas reductions. It's really sad, but I think Japan is a horrible example of what's going on in many places in the world. We're not cutting back on greenhouse gases. We need nukes. We need 1,000 nukes at least, and we're not getting it.
Yeah, unless I have to check the figures, but I think that you may have. The number may actually be closer to $1 billion a week. The numbers that I have found have been somewhere between $40 and $50 billion a year for additional fossil fuel purchases. One thing that people need to remember is that this idea that there's cheap natural gas that can be used as a replacement for nuclear is only a North American phenomenon.
Right.
Natural gas in Japan costs fully 5 to 6 times what it costs at Henry Hub in the North American market. So, you know, there's nothing cheap about taking natural gas out of the ground under the ocean in Qatar, liquefying it, transporting it via tanker all the way to Japan, and then gasifying it to burn for electricity in Japan. And, of course, they get some LNG from Australia and a few other places. But
they get a lot from Russia, too.
Maybe. I think that Russia's getting ready to produce LNG to sell to
a few tankers went through this summer when the Northern Passage was open from Russia, a couple of LNG tankers. There were some articles on that in the Japanese press. I mean, it's nothing like they're getting from the Middle East or Australia.
Right.
But that is another source for them.
I thought that was a really interesting article, too. I remember that the tanker was going through, and because it was a Northern Passage, it was summer and it should have been open, but there was a nuclear-powered icebreaker going ahead of it in case it got into trouble. Do you remember that?
Yeah, they did that last summer, too, but they weren't sending any liquid natural gas through last summer. This past summer was the first time they've done that. And just to be on the safe side, I firmly believe that's going to become a usual and customary practice for quite a while.
Well, if I was to be running an icebreaker, I would definitely want it to be nuclear-powered.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a video in my library of a 1996, I think it was a PBS documentary called Icebreakers to the North or something like that. And it's just an amusing event to me, because the whole video is about this Canadian and U.S. joint mission to get two icebreakers to get to the North Pole. And it's all the scientists are all, you know, working hard, and the people are worried about the challenge of getting up there. And just as they get close to the North Pole, here comes this Russian icebreaker doing 12 knots through the ice and carrying a group of about 60 school children who get off the ship and sing songs around the North Pole. It's like, oh, that was hard for you guys? We thought it was pretty easy. We do this all the time. It's still amusing me. I've got a few clips on that. But all right. So there's also been a couple of anniversaries in 2013. 1953, December, I can't remember the exact date in December, President Eisenhower gave a speech at the United Nations in which he talked a lot about the hazards to the world about nuclear weapons, but also towards the end of the speech offered the possibility of using atoms for peace and offering a lot of technical assistance to countries who were willing to forego the use of nuclear weapons, and the U.S. would help them with producing peaceful uses of peaceful uses of nuclear materials. So that happened this year. It was a 60-year anniversary of Atoms for Peace.
Right.
The American Nuclear Society celebrated the 75th anniversary of the very basic physical phenomena that allows us to create reliable heat from uranium and thorium and plutonium. So the fission chain reaction was only found in a laboratory 75 years ago, 1938.
Right.
It's pretty amazing for people who sometimes dismiss nuclear as, oh, that's old stuff. You know, we want something new like wind and solar.
Which have only been around for thousands of years.
And then what I find ironic is that 30 to 40 years ago, nuclear was considered to be the new kid on the block, and it was, we were experimenting with the human race and all kinds of other negative things. Now that's turned around, that we're old school, and over such a short period of time, I just find that kind of, well, if I can be bold, I find it ridiculous.
You know, I always, when I get involved in these conversations, I point to the fact that my still very healthy and active mother was 5 years old when fission was first discovered in a laboratory.
Wow.
You know, it's a generational thing to realize just how short a period of time over the span of human history people have known about fission, and look how far we got, although we haven't done too much with it over the last 25 or 30 years. Too much growth, I should say. We've obviously continued to operate the plants that we built. But we do have some plants under construction. The progress at Vogtle, despite all previous word to the contrary, I just listened to Tom Fanning, who's the CEO of Southern Company, and he states that although the project was delayed by the awarding of the COL by almost a year, it is moving along pretty well and is actually operating at a point that is below their budgeted numbers. Now, they've spent more on certain parts of the plant, but they've saved a lot on financing that was initially budgeted because, you know, they happened to pick a good time when interest rates are pretty low. So that was good news to me.
I think another thing I've liked recently is to see some very positive ads about nuclear by the Southern Company. You know, the guy with the little ping pong balls and BBs, and I don't, and Westinghouse also had some ads. It's nice to see that these companies are not just not saying anything, while meanwhile, you know, clean natural gas blankets the, you know, the buses and the airwaves and the posters in the airports and everything, and meanwhile, you know, nobody ever says a nice word about nuclear. There have been some nice ads recently.
Meredith, just out of curiosity, where have you seen the ads?
Unfortunately, just on the web. But I mean, that just may be me. Do you know the ones I mean?
Yeah, I know the ones you mean. That's why I was asking, because unfortunately, I watch more television than I really should. But I haven't seen them.
I don't watch television mostly at all, right. So I couldn't really say how. But just the fact they exist, that they're even on the web, is amazing to me.
Yes. Unfortunately, in advertising, repetition matters. And, you know, there are certain commercials. I've been watching a lot of football games recently because it's bowl week and more bowl season, and seen a tremendous, I should have started a count, you know, a little logbook next to my watching table, so that I could keep track of how many commercials I've seen from Exxon about, you know, most of our energy comes from right here. You know, if we used LED lights, we would save this much electricity. There's an enormous number of ads coming from ExxonMobil and from Chevron and others about their products. And I still haven't seen the first ad for anything related to nuclear energy over the 25 bowl games I've watched. So that bothers me. And so if anybody from the nuclear industry listens to this and has any say, please think about this, folks. You know, we need to get people's attention. We need to help them understand that nuclear is a competitive, clean energy source.
Well, they're advertising on Toronto Maple Leafs radio, if that means anything. It means something here in Ontario, but I wish it would be. I wish it was television ads as well.
Well, now I was going to say Bruce Power has been running some actual advertising campaigns, things like coal down, nuclear up, or I should say that maybe I said it the other way, nuclear
it's
up.
It's the other
coal
way
down.
Around, nuclear up, coal down. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, the PW and the radio ads has been really good. They've been hammering away at a number of themes, all of which emphasize the fact that nuclear is at least 50% of our electricity at any given time. But that's in one market. It's an important market. It's probably the most important market. They've targeted it really well. It would be really nice to see more general advertising elsewhere and in media that more people are watching.
Well, I do know that there, if you are a driver in Washington, D.C., you're a commuter, you will hear advertisements on WTOP, which is the largest traffic radio station. So NEI does run them there. And if you are a Capitals fan, you'll see things associated with Capitals hockey.
But NEI's ads, because I get NEI's ads a lot in my, like, sidebars, they're advertising for NEI. They're not, they have the big NEI logo, which is an acronym, and then it, like, very small underneath says, you know, nuclear clean air or something. So, like, instead of being clever like other lobby groups where they're advertising the energy source, and then it says this ad is paid for by such and such group, NEI is doing self-promotion for NEI, and the nuclear word is not the focus. of their advertising. So to me, that's a little like, come on, guys, you're so close. Like, it's good, you're advertising, but take that next step and commit to advertising the product versus promoting yourselves.
Good point.
What can you do?
we can do what we're doing. We can sit around and grouse and record the grousing and publish that. So maybe somebody will listen.
Yeah, perhaps. That would be great.
I also think there's a lot of fear on the part of the different entities in the so-called nuclear industry, the different utilities. They're afraid if they put the word nuclear up, it's going to hurt their image somehow. I mean, that this was a feeling when I was working, you know, full-time in the industry back in the 70s and 80s, and I think it's pretty much the same today, or maybe not as bad, I don't know, but I still think it's there. There's a fear of being associated with nuclear for some reason.
There's no doubt that they're afraid of stuff. It's all about losing their jobs. If they say something that offends the politician who's in charge of the energy file, they'll lose their jobs. That's what this is about. If the government's got the industry cowed in that respect, like the major industry players who are actually making money and by using nuclear, they live in fear of just that. So that's a problem.
Is that in Canada, Steve?
Sorry?
Is that in Canada?
Yeah, in Ontario. Yeah. Because we're still, our nuclear assets are still publicly owned. Publicly owned means that the provincial government runs that file, and the provincial government makes the ultimate decisions. So it's the utility can plan all at once, can suggest all at once. It really is the government that decides where this is going to go. And the government makes, this is an amazing surprise, the government makes political decisions based
Holy
on whether
cow.
It thinks it can get elected. So,
wow.
I'm shocked.
Well, yeah, I know.
There's gambling going on there?
Yeah.
There's politics in government? Okay.
Yeah. So that's a problem. It's good in one way. It's good that politicians ultimately are in charge of big decisions. This is a democracy and all that. But at the same time, you've got a highly technical file. You've got deliberate misinformation for political purposes being put out there, and utility executives not able, for fear of losing their jobs. And if they lose their jobs, they're absolutely ineffective. So I understand it from their point of view. If they publicly oppose what is being put out there by politicians, they will pay the price. So it's a tricky situation.
One other thing I'd like to add here in the States, you know, nuclear is we're still only producing 20% of the electricity that's being consumed. Coal and gas are the big boys on the block, and in many utilities, the ones I work for, they use a variety of different sources, and they feel if they promote nuclear, then they're going to actually be competing against their major source of income, which is coal and natural gas. I don't know how many times I was told, you don't bite the hand that fed you.
Yeah. Really interesting situation in the history of the public utility, both in your side of the border and mine, that is impacting this issue. It used to be not as big a problem as it is now, but because of deregulation and that kind of thing, boy, there's some crazy decisions being made.
Well, that's one of the things that I saw an interview of Tom Fanning by Platts Energy Week. I guess he was interviewed about a week or so ago. And one of the questions was about the whole aspect of deregulation. And Fanning came down very strongly. Of course, he runs a regulated utility. But he said people have lost sight of the fact that electricity is a basic ingredient of our industrial economy. And that if you have trying to have people making decisions about what kind of generation to build based on hour-to-hour changes in prices, bid by markets, is that just can't work because the time constants are just completely different. You can't make a multi-decade decision based on hour-to-hour variations in prices. And he said all that does is it drives very short-term thinking, and it's going to be a real problem if we don't take the action to look around and maybe do some re-regulation and giving the opportunity to make some long-term decisions. And of course, that's part of the whole thing that happened in England. Another event for 2013 is that finally the UK made an agreement with a nuclear vendor for a strike price that will be guaranteed for a long period of time. I think it's 35 years with an EPR at Hinkley C, if I'm not mistaken. Is the Hinkley Point C?
I think two EPRs.
Is that right? Two.
I think it's a very, very sizable amount of new capacity.
Actually, you know, I think you're right, and if there's a second, there is an agreement for one, but there's also an agreement that's already been signed that if there's a second one, the strike price goes down, because EDF made it very clear to people that, hey, if you make me build only one of these, it's going to be much more expensive than if you allow me to build two.
Yep. And guess what? Politically, the sky didn't fall in for David Cameron. So it doesn't look like their coalition is in jeopardy over this decision. They've got unhappy partners who are unhappy out of partisan ideology, but that's basically it. It doesn't look like the sky fell in, and so this might that's a really positive development in the industry so far this year in 2013.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a major milestone, and the UK is an important country because it's small enough to be able to move pretty quickly. If it makes a decision, the UK could do a France in decarbonizing its electrical grid in probably less than two decades.
That's a goal that they could reasonably achieve. They're at 430 grams per kilowatt hour, their grid. France is about around 70, around 80, just below 80. It would take some doing, but they could reach that, and it's with the public reaction that's happened over this decision over Hinkley. Who knows? Like if the technology gets a chance to prove itself, I could see that becoming the main electricity source in the UK, which would be very positive.
That would be a real coup, really.
Boy.
Okay. Another event that happened in 2013 is that the Department of Energy made its second award under its small modular reactor program and chose NuScale as the winner of that second award. How many of you followed this story?
I have. Yeah.
I followed your reports on it, Rod. That's about it. I've been kind of with Japanese stuff.
Well, see, sometimes, Les, you take care of the Japanese stuff, I'll take care of this other stuff. No?
Speaking of NuScale and small modular reactors, Japan ought to be talking to NuScale because the reactor design is seismically intelligent. The reactors float in a pool. Mm-hmm. So if there's an earthquake, they don't get smashed. They don't get torn apart.
Jostled.
Well,
just bob around.
The NuScale, I believe that the reason the DOE probably picked NuScale is that although it's also light water technology like the B&W M-Power, NuScale has made some very significant choices that are different from where B&W went on M-Power. And I think that the DOE said, you know, if we're going to support two projects, they ought to be enough different so that we can make a decision as to which path is better, and or that the market can make a decision which path is better. And the big change between NuScale and M-Power although they, from the outside, look kind of similar. NuScale doesn't have any reactor coolant pumps. It is their 45 megawatt natural circulation. And for the whole power output, they don't have any main coolant pumps, which means...
So, no Fukushima.
It is, yeah. And, well, there, as you, there's a whole series of decisions they made that make it so that a Fukushima-type event where you lost power to your diesel or your backup power supply would be a non-issue on a NuScale reactor. Now, B&W's philosophy was they would have enough backup sources of power and enough diversity in that those backup sources that they also would not have an issue. And they also use natural circulation under accident conditions. In other words, when you're not trying to make any electricity, a B&W M-Power reactor also uses natural circulation for decay heat removal. But there's some fault. Yes.
I wanted to comment on something that I think is interesting about NuScale, too, is the development path of the technology. Coming out of the university system and the way that the design has progressed, you know, and now getting DOE funding and potentially getting licensed, it's very unique. And if it works, if it makes it to commercialization, will really represent a new pathway for emergent nuclear technologies. And so I think that aspect of it for me is really exciting, because I know so many of the young people coming into nuclear in their careers are interested in this. They're interested in developing advanced reactors and in solving some of these old problems that the larger LWRs have. And so this means that there's a real connect there, that kids can do this work early on in their careers with a chance of seeing that technology in their lifetime actually get commercialized. So I just wanted to point that out. And I was just at Berkeley, and they are working on a reactor there, and they are hoping for a similar trajectory. So it's already sort of being replicated.
That's a great observation, Susie. I had not thought about it that way, but yeah, having reactor designs come out of academia and proving
it's phenomenal. And with the industry partnerships, you know, they get the creativity and the credibility of the big company. So I think it's just brilliant. I really want to see them succeed.
That is exciting, because one of the downsides to most of the nukes we have in this country is many of them, the nuclear portion of the plant came from GE, Westinghouse, Babcock, Wilcox, what have you. But the remainder of the plant that was producing the electricity, the steam and condensate systems, they were largely designed by fossil fuel engineers.
Right, yes.
And I ran into a lot of problems with that. Like, we had 22 release points on one nuclear plant because the guy that did the ventilation design was, a fossil fuel engineer. And I just hand-drew a quick redesign of the ventilation system to knock it down to 3 release points, and basically had to get a vice presidential decision made to go from 22 to 3 release points. And from a nuclear standpoint, there's really no argument there. 22 release points for one power plant? That's ridiculous. But these people didn't understand. And there were other problems that other people ran into in other parts of the operations group with our design, because it was not designed by nukes. But if you get this coming from academia, and then the industry picking up on it, if you will, that's brilliant. I love it. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting project to follow, and I'm happy that a company that is purely focused on nuclear development is pushing forward. because, as we've talked about before, sometimes when your company does many things in the energy business, some you can have conflicts of interest or internecine rivalries, and just having difficulty in taking advantage of some of the real benefits that your technology has over the competition because you're afraid to emphasize them. I believe it's important. Comparative advertising works. And, you know, the only real way you can convince people that your product is worth buying is to compare it to what their other alternatives for the same task are. So I think it's a good thing that we have some pure nuclear plays out there. I'm just hoping that someday in the not-too-distant future, NuScale is going to have enough things going for it that they'll be entering the public markets rather than be a company that's basically wholly owned by an investor called Fluor. In other words, I want to buy stock in this company.
Right. Maybe. Well, they went through a rocky time, NuScale did, with the hijinks of a backer. And Fluor saved their bacon.
Well, I have to tell you that there are times when the advice of my colleagues who were Marines when I was in the Navy comes to mind. That which doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Absolutely, I think it did.
I think that NuScale having to go through those hard times and having employees that essentially said, we really like this so much, and we know that you guys are really working hard to get an investor. We'll keep working for minimum wage.
Which they did.
I know.
They absolutely hung in there with great fidelity because they believed in the product.
Which is impressive not just from, you know, our outside point of view, but it's got to be impressive for the potential customers to know that the design engineers felt that strongly about the quality of their work. And the potential reliability of the systems they were designing, that they were willing to keep going.
Yeah.
Doesn't this just run counter to all of the sort of anti-nuclear narratives about big corporations and, you know, thoughtless sort of business managers who don't care about the technology, they don't care about the public or the environment? Like, these dedicated individuals, you know, putting their careers at stake to see this thing through. Brilliant.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, of course, you know, the narrative of the faceless utility guys was never very believable for me because, you know, the utility guy I knew was my dad, you know. He wasn't exactly faceless. He was probably one of the nicest and most moral men I've ever met. And, you know, he and his colleagues, you know, I hung out with a lot of utility guys when I was growing up because Dad was an engineer for a utility company, and his friends were my mentors. So I never really understood that. But it is a meme that has played very well in the anti-nuclear movement. You know, people don't like the power company for some odd reason. You know, I've lived in a lot of places where the power company guys were heroes.
They're heroes in Toronto right now. There's a huge blackout over Christmas, and believe me, these guys are
working their butts off. Yeah, and, you know, you never have experienced how important those power guys can be until you've lived without power for, say, 2 or 3 weeks, and the truck finally rolls into your neighborhood, and you have the guys in the hard hats and their rubber gloves put those lines back up and turn on that magic switch again.
Yep.
So, Gwyneth, I think you probably experienced that up in the Northeast, didn't you?
Absolutely. 2 hurricanes. Sandy, we only had power out for 4 days, but the previous year, I'm forgetting the name of the hurricane at the moment, but a year or two earlier, we had 10 days without power. And believe me, I have a box full of solar lanterns, and my husband is all for oil lamps and stuff like that. You know, we have a lot of alternative sources, but there's nothing like being able to put clothes in a washing machine and turn it on.
Yep.
And then put the clothes in the dryer. It's, if anyone has been liberated by electricity, it's women.
Absolutely.
You know, to not have to pound the clothes at the river and all of that. You realize what a miraculous thing electricity is. And boy, do you rejoice when that truck comes up your driveway and the hard hat guys get out and, you know, fix your wires and stuff so you can have electricity again. It's a fantastic experience.
Okay, so I'm going to move the show to what do we want to have happen in 2014? Do we have any reasonable predictions for what events might occur this coming year?
I think that the climate change story is going to heat up, so to speak, and that there's going to be a lot more discussion, inevitably, about nuclear power. As more people, as people continue to wake up, continue to write editorials in places like the New York Times and so on, favoring nuclear power, and I think that's only going to continue as the controversy heats up with the fossil fuel companies, who want to continue to emit carbon dioxide and so on. So it's going to be interesting.
I agree with that prediction. I'm going to work to make it come true.
Great.
I think we all will.
One of the best ways to be a successful predictor of the future is to be an inventor of the future.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to make a prediction that a major environmental group is going to come out with a official policy change sometime in 2014. I think that the pressure is on for a group. I don't know what it's going to be, WWF or Sierra or NRDC or
Greenpeace.
Somebody's going to come out and say, in the light of climate change, we have decided that we cannot try to suppress the use of nuclear energy anymore.
And admit that renewables can't run Toyota factories, you know, or you cannot put some windmills around a factory and just sit back and let the power flow. So I think when reality, which there's been a tremendous ability to fantasize in the renewable sector and to tell people, oh, no, we can get everything from wind and solar and the tidal bore or something like that. I think that sensible people are going to keep coming around as the environmental movement looks to solutions about climate change.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is there's a couple of major solar projects going on in the desert Southwest where environmentalists are recognizing there's some real negatives associated with large-scale wind and solar projects that need to be addressed and maybe not even can't be overcome.
For one thing, they like to choose pristine land, which tends to be a national forest and things like that.
Well, that's because they can get it cheap.
Yeah, and it really is a blight on the landscape. It's an industrial operation, just as wind farms are, with all that concrete and steel covering a huge piece of land. Or you can have a little nuclear plant
right.
with little fuel pellets, and waste being extremely small and a much lower life cycle carbon emission chart.
Well, it's also important to help people understand a few things. It's not, and even some of the, you know, that letter from the climate scientists supporting nuclear still gave a misimpression. It said, the problem is renewables can't scale fast enough. The problem is renewables can't do the job.
Exactly.
They can't supply
reliable. There's this theory that if we have like a billion windmills, we don't need anything. I mean, that's
as long as they're all connected, and
yeah,
as long as the guy who has, you know, he has a certain power need, he allows the company to build twice or three times as much wind capacity in his area, so that when the wind is not blowing somewhere else, he has enough to sell to the other guys.
And you have to have a grid.
Right.
You have to redo the grid and go through people's backyards who may not say that's okay. Laying down cable to get the windmills from in North Dakota powering New York City. Or, you know, that's the kind of daydreams that people have like that. I don't see that happening in any realistic fashion.
Meredith, I think I heard you start to say something.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that in Vermont, we had this wind turbine farm, and basically during a very, very cold snap, there was a lot of requirement for electricity, and the wind was blowing, and the wind farm couldn't get on the grid. I mean, in other words, it had to be curtailed because the local grid was just at complete capacity, and the wind farm didn't have synchronizer that would help it get on the grid, and so its power was going to disrupt the power that was already there, and even with the synchronizer, it would only some of its power could be there. And people were like, this is a total state of shock about, oh, how can you not let the wind on the grid? And the answer is that because the physical requirements of the grid actually take precedence over our theoretical requirements that wind is, you know, the best kind of energy, you know, much better than fossil or nuclear or whatever. That's a theoretical dispatching requirement. An actual thing is that you have to keep the grid going. And to build a grid that will be able to take wind when it comes up at the same time that other things are flowing, you'd have to overbuild it so much, and who's paying for it? I put in one of my
Subsidies.
Well, you know, the subsidies work for the wind turbines themselves, but then when you begin putting subsidies on the grid, people begin pushing back.
Oh yeah.
Even if they like that wind turbine there, they don't actually want to spend a whole lot of money on the grid to get it get the power available.
Well, there's a big problem in the Northwest with the grid. And problems that caused by the wind farms. They constantly have to be juggling stuff because of the wind.
Oh, yeah. Isn't Columbia the only U.S. nuclear station that does, like, load meeting? They run Columbia differently, I believe, deal with the...
You know,
renewable.
It's fun, and here's the funny thing that happened out at Columbia recently was that Columbia, because it is operated as a load-following plant, they actually curtail the output of Columbia because they have to curtail something. When the wind is blowing and the dams are full, you know, you can either spill water or feather your wind turbine blades or crank down your nuclear plant. Because of that operation, Columbia's cost per unit of electricity is higher than average for a nuclear plant.
Yeah.
Because part of the year it's there and still has cost, still has operators to pay, but it's not producing as much electricity as it could. So its cost is higher than average. So the Physicians for Social Responsibility commissioned somebody to do a study and prove that it would be cheaper for the ratepayers in the Northwest if they shut down Columbia and replaced it with natural gas. And it would be better for the environment, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
According to the Physician for Social Responsibility.
Yeah, it's only half as polluting as coal.
You know, it actually is 66% as polluting as coal, unless the generator is more efficient. But that's not really the fault of the gas. That's the designer of the generator.
Technology.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I'm looking at my clock here, and I realize that we're at about 80 minutes already. So I'm going to offer each one of you a little round opportunity for a summary, and then we'll say goodnight. So, Meredith, go ahead.
Well, I just enjoyed this conversation a lot because, you know, when I look back at 2013, I mean, I am kind of overwhelmed by the sudden decision of Entergy's. I mean, a very unexpected decision for many of us to close Vermont Yankee. And so I just like looking back at all the other things which I knew were happening and was involved in, like, to some extent, like Pandora's Promise and the writ of mandamus about Yucca Mountain, and just remembering, oh yeah, it was a mixed year. It wasn't a bad year. It was a mixed year.
Steve?
Well, I'm looking forward to a reversal of the decision here in Ontario to take nuclear out of the long-term energy plan. I think that decision can happen if with the right nudge. And what Gwyneth mentioned earlier about the likelihood that carbon and climate change are going to attain greater prominence in the public discussion, I think that in that context, this decision could be made. But I'm really unhappy with a lot of things that happened last year, and particularly the decision about Vermont Yankee. Because that cost some people their jobs. That's not a good thing.
Hundreds of people.
Hundreds of people.
So far. There's going to be other impacts of that decision.
Yeah, we're going to watch. GHGs out of Vermont and in the immediate area go up because as a result of this. That's not a good thing.
And I wouldn't be surprised if the cost of electricity goes up enough in Vermont to cause other major employers to look for other places to do business. Susie, your turn.
Okay. On a more positive note, I have reason to believe that 2014 is going to be a good year for educational outreach and dialogue, both in the U.S. and globally, and I'm thrilled for that. I think there's been a real change of tide with the understanding and investment in public communication, and so I think it's going to be a big year.
Well, that's good to hear. Les?
I'm looking forward to some more sanity with respect to our nuclear waste rulings in the government. I think we've had a little sanity this year. It's a step in the right direction. I'm looking forward to a few more steps in the right direction. And I'm intrigued by your prediction, Rod, about one of our environmental groups maybe flipping their switch, and I got a feeling it might be Friends of the Earth. That just keeps coming to mind, but that's what I'm looking for. I'm kind of looking forward to something like that happening, too. I think it's inevitable, so why can't it start this year?
I hope it's inevitable.
Gwyneth?
Well, I hope all these predictions, in the positive sense, occur, and that, yes, that a major environmental group, wakes up and actually says what some of them probably are secretly believing and approves nuclear power. And there are five new nuclear plants, five new reactors in progress in the United States. So that's something. Yeah, we've lost some, but some more being built. And worldwide, as Susie pointed out, nuclear power is just growing. So if you look at the big picture, overall, nuclear is making gains. And I think people will continue to who view nuclear differently. Partly, I think, because Fukushima wound up not killing anyone. I mean, they just can't find anyone who's died of radiation poisoning from Fukushima, including the guys who were waiting around in the radioactive water. And I think that, in a strange way, has maybe helped people, you know, write editorials that are pro-nuclear power.
I agree. And there is one more event that is scheduled to happen in 2014, which I am rooting remains on schedule, and that's the submission of the first design certification application for a small modular reactor. B&W is scheduled to submit their application this year, according to the NRC's schedule. And I just hope they remain on track, because those kinds of things can be delayed if should be delayed if necessary. By the way, if the application is not complete, I certainly hope that nobody says, "Well, we better submit it anyway," because that would be bad and cause a lot of delays later. All right. So thank you all for your participation tonight. I hope you all have a great nuke year and a great new year. And, you know, it didn't have to be, there's all kinds of other things going on in your lives besides nuclear energy. And I hope that all that goes well too. I guess for me, the biggest event on a personal note for me in 2013 from a nuclear perspective was the decision to become a full-time writer, advocate, Yay. Consultant, etc. on nuclear energy. And from a personal perspective, the most important thing about 2013 is that I tripled my population of grandchildren from one to three.
Fabulous. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Rod.
Grandchildren are always fun, because you can always give them back.
You know, my mother used to say that, and I haven't felt that yet, but then I'm kind of lucky. Both my grandchildren are fabulous.
No, I'm just teasing. They are terrific, and I know that at least, let's see, there's at least three grandparents on the call here, and I think we'll all agree, grandkids are great, and they're terrific motivators for people that want to think long-term and try to make the world a better place. And all of you are doing that, and keep on the good work of trying to make the world a better place. Take care.
Well, you too. Thank you.
Pleasure speaking with you all, you guys. Ladies and gentlemen, I should say.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.